Welcome to The Rift, a radio show about climate change, ecology, politics, and power. My name is Roshan Krishnan, and you're listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM here in East Central Illinois, and streaming all over the world at weft.org. Happy New Year's, everyone. Today is Sunday, January 5th, 2025, and this is episode 5 of The Rift, our first of the new year. Our world runs on fossil fuels. It's a simple fact that despite lofty rhetoric about the ostensible transition to renewable energy, the cheapening price of solar and battery storage, and various policy initiatives designed to create and subsidize markets for alternative energy solutions, global fossil fuel consumption continues unabated and has in fact been reaching record highs with each successive year. In 2023, fossil fuel consumption resulted in the emission of 40 gigatons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, the highest annual level ever recorded. The clean energy sector is growing, but overall demand for energy is growing faster, to say nothing of the way that fossil fuels have permeated our lives through manufactured products that use oil and gas derivatives, including everything from plastics and electronics to clothing and even toothpaste. Fossil fuels are deeply enmeshed in our society and our political economy. As scholars like Andreas Malm and Timothy Mitchell have argued, they have shaped the very nature of capitalism and democracy, from the Industrial Revolution and the advent of steam power, to the oil crises of the 1970s, to the shale boom of the past decade. And while there is much to be said about the primacy of fossil fuels as a substance and as a commodity, and their material influence on our society, politics, and ecology, in recent years, many activists and researchers have drawn attention specifically to the strategies employed by the companies that produce and sell fossil fuels. These companies, particularly oil and gas majors, are some of the most powerful political actors in the world. They have, through various means, influenced international relations, domestic policy of governments the world over, and global climate negotiations. Just last November, COP29, the United Nations Global Climate Summit in Azerbaijan, was attended by over 1,700 lobbyists for coal, oil, and gas companies, a greater number of fossil fuel lobbyists than the size of all but three individual countries' delegations to the conference. But perhaps the most notorious political project of the oil and gas industry is its decade-long campaign of climate denialism. There's now ample historical research that has found that oil and gas company scientists learned about the planet-warming and greenhouse gas effects of carbon dioxide emissions well before that knowledge became well known to the general public. In 2015, an investigation by Inside Climate News found that scientists at Exxon, now the oil multinational ExxonMobil, had produced research on the threat of carbon emissions as early as 1977. In fact, a subsequent study published last year by researchers at Harvard and the University of Potsdam in Germany found that Exxon's internal research in the 70s and 80s actually produced remarkably accurate projections of the effects of global warming. Nevertheless, Exxon and many of its oil industry peers responded to this research by essentially burying it and instead engaging in extensive political lobbying and public relations campaigns to intentionally obscure and spread misinformation about the effects of fossil fuels on the climate, what we know today as the roots of climate denialism. Since the 2015 investigation on ExxonMobil, further reporting has found evidence of climate denialism and lobbying among various oil companies and industry associations dating back as far as the 1950s. One such report was just published last November in the climate news outlet DSmog, revealing climate and air pollution denialism by the Western States Petroleum Association, the oil industry's oldest lobbying group that originated over 70 years ago. That report was authored by Rebecca John, a UK-based investigative journalist and documentary filmmaker, who is also a research fellow at the Climate Investigation Center. For today's show, I was fortunate enough to speak with Rebecca about her new report. After the break, you'll hear our conversation about her research into the Western States Petroleum Association, and broader patterns and practices of climate denial and political lobbying across the oil and gas industry. But first, programming here at WEFT is brought to you just by listeners just like you, as well as Cinema Gallery in downtown Urbana. A proud supporter of WEFT, Cinema Gallery is located at 120 West Main Street in the historic Urbana Cinema and represents 52 professional artists of the Midwest. For more information, visit cinemagallery.cc or follow Cinema Gallery on Instagram. Programming on WEFT is also brought to you, in part, by the Krannert Center for Performing Arts. The spring semester will begin January 25th with blues by the Jontavious Willis Band and multi-instrumentalist Michel Ndigiocello's No More Water, The Gospel of James Baldwin, on January 28th. Complete information on these performances is available online at krannertcenter.com. And now, here's my conversation with investigative journalist Rebecca John. I'm joined now by investigative reporter Rebecca John. Rebecca, thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, Roshan. Thanks so much for inviting me on the show. It's great to be here.
Of course. So you've conducted some extensive research into the Western States Petroleum Association, the oil industry's oldest lobbying group, and the Air Pollution Foundation, which is the front group that it created in order to produce industry-friendly research. And you ended up unraveling a pretty remarkable history of climate change and air pollution denialism. Could you tell me about what you found, the significance of WSPA's involvement, and sort of the players that were involved?
Yes, thank you. Yeah. So the history shows that in 1953, the Western States Petroleum Association, as you say, the oil industry's oldest lobbying group in the US, which is known as WSPA or WSPA in California for short, formed along with California's major oil and gas companies, formed and funded a group called the Air Pollution Foundation as a front group to help protect themselves against local air pollution regulation that was being formulated by the LA County authorities to combat the region's smog problem. And what you see in the documents is that WSPA intended for the Air Pollution Foundation to act as a vehicle through which the oil and gas industry could sponsor and publicize research that would be, and I'm quoting here, protective, and that the foundation would serve as, again, a quote from its own documents, the research department for the oil industry, and that its findings would be accepted as unbiased where the industry's own findings were not trusted. So that's key evidence of what seems like the first oil industry front group set up to fight air pollution regulation and diffuse public anger over the smog problem. So, for example, in 1954, after 10 days of non-stop toxic smog, around 6,000 people protested in downtown Pasadena, calling for the authorities to enforce a solution, which was obviously a big threat from the industry's point of view to their operations. And what you see in the documents is, at this point, industry trying to bridge a credibility gap by filtering research through the foundation as a front group. And this was research that positioned industry as responsible, as proactively trying to solve the smog problem. However, it was also research which might place the focus of the cause of the smog problem on cars, on backyard trash incineration, which was widespread across Los Angeles at the time, or weather patterns. And, you know, which could like pinpoint these as small sources of smog rather than refineries. And the irony was that it was through this front group, through one of the research projects commissioned by the foundation, that WSPA and California's largest oil and gas companies, so we're talking about Shell, SoCalGas, Southern California Edison, and the predecessor companies of what now known as ExxonMobil, Chevron, BP, and ConocoPhillips, were informed in 1954, so 70 years ago, that burning fossil fuels was likely causing an increase in carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, and that this increase, with reference to climate, might in future be of considerable significance to civilization. Now, those quotes are taken from a research proposal submitted to the Foundation in 1954. So clearly that's the industry being put on notice of the dangers of burning fossil fuels, the dangers of accumulating CO2 in the atmosphere 70 years ago. You also mentioned denialism, and that's really important, because what we see in the documents, the industry being warned about CO2's climate risk in 1954 and early 1955, at exactly the same time that the Air Pollution Foundation's president was calling for statewide air pollution controls on emissions and calling for investigations into refinery emissions, which Whisper and the big oil companies, predominantly the precursors of Chevron and ExxonMobil, did not like at all. And they reprimanded him for this. They pulled him into a meeting at the city's very exclusive California club and told him in no uncertain terms what they expected for their, you know, in return for their hefty financial contributions, outlining that the APF should be protective. They criticized him for conducting too broad a program of research and drawing attention to refinery emissions. And immediately after that point, we see Whisper and the oil industry exerting a much greater influence over their, you know, fledgling front group, scaling back its research program, boosting its public relations function, and sidelining its president, who eventually resigned. So essentially what you have is a group of oil executives deciding really to dismiss and downplay the harms of burning fossil fuels to protect their business, in the same way that their later counterparts did, and in some cases their current counterparts are still doing. So coming back to denial, after 1955, after this meeting, no other Air Pollution Foundation publication that I found, at least so far, refers to the climate risks of burning fossil fuels. Yeah, so, you know, after this point, the APF, Air Pollution Foundation publications, refer to carbon dioxide as innocuous. And in 1958, a California oil executive from Shell, who was also a Whisper air pollution expert and a member of the Foundation's technical advisory committee, publicly described carbon dioxide as harmless at a national air pollution conference in Washington, D.C., convened by the U.S. government. So, you know, the significance of Whisper's involvement here is twofold. You know, we can trace a direct paper trail warning, you know, in documents warning the industry about climate risk of burning fossil fuels. And we can also see this pattern of denial emerging that the industry repeated later on, right? So in the late 80s and 90s. And we can see how Whisper founded and funded what's likely maybe the air pollution's, it seems to be anyway, the oil industry's first front group aimed at protecting oil companies from air pollution regulation, something that Whisper and the industry continues to do to this day in order to prevent clean air regulation and climate action, and to prolong so-called business as usual, despite the fact that we're facing a climate emergency.
Wow, yeah, that's a lot to take in. I'm especially fascinated by the fact that they seem to have, as you mentioned, hired a head of this front group that kind of did his job a little too well. And then very quickly they learned to sort of exert their power over that group and really set the direction of that research agenda. So as you were starting to get at, you know, that's sort of continued to this day. And I wanted to ask about what that looks like at present, and how it relates to some of the litigation that you've connected it to in your reporting, on the West Coast.
Yes, well, this is really interesting. So more recently, Whisper has continued to influence public opinion and block clean air regulations, as well as state climate initiatives through third-party front groups like Californians for Energy Independence and Californians Against Higher Taxes, which have used industry-sponsored research to battle reform. And in 2014, a leaked PowerPoint presentation revealed that Whisper was supporting more than a dozen front groups in campaigns designed to look like they were grassroots in nature, but were in fact opposed to clean air and climate policies funded by WISPR. And many of these groups are still actively opposing similar measures today, with reports showing that actually in the 10 years since that slide deck was released, WISPR has channeled over $30 million to front groups working in this space, while tax filings show that in general, in total, these front groups have received around $115 million. So it's a very well-funded, widely based enterprise. In relation to the climate deception litigation, in November 2024, WISPR was named as a defendant in an Oregon climate lawsuit for its support of front groups listed in that leaked presentation. And the complaint alleges that WISPR funded the front groups as part of a $1 million public relations campaign to further the oil industry's propaganda machine. And it also cites WISPR's use of front groups to deny the harms of the use of fossil fuels, and it alleges that WISPR conducted a stealth campaign to influence public opinion and lull the public into continuing to purchase fossil fuels. So that's Oregon. California itself, where this early research shows WISPR being a major player in establishing kind of the later foundations for climate denial, for sowing doubt on air pollution, and trying to prevent regulation in California, which was really ground zero for these activities. WISPR haven't been named in the California climate deception lawsuit, although many of its members, including ExxonMobil, Chevron, BP, Shell, and ConocoPhillips, have been named. But it's interesting because the Attorney General, Rob Bonta, has stated that he's open to adding more defendants to the case. So it's definitely a space to watch. And there are some groups calling for WISPR to be included, such as there's a group called Elected Officials to Protect America. And the current executive director, who is the former mayor of Culver City in California, has urged that WISPR be added to the suit.
Got it. I'm struck by your mention of these front groups made to look like grassroots groups. I think that's been something that I've seen all over the place, especially actually here in the American Midwest, certainly in Illinois, but also, you know, I the county that I grew up in Indiana, a rural county, actually has a ban on utility scale wind farms. And so many of the conflicts around rural land use have been essentially driven by groups that we are now learning are funded by oil money. So obviously the use of front groups to sway public opinion and engage in policy advocacy, it's pretty common practice, not just in the oil industry, but many others. I've also seen investor-owned electric utilities here in the States do all kinds of stuff around that. Chemical companies, real estate, you name it, right? So in your eyes, has that practice changed or evolved at all over the years, that, you know, since the 40s and 50s when WISPO was just dipping its toes in the water, so to speak?
Yeah. Oh, this is fascinating. It's great to get into this area because it's so important. And you're exactly right. It's endemic. I think that's one change. The practice has become much more widespread, probably because it's so effective, unfortunately. But, you know, even back in the 50s, the oil industry weren't the first to use a front group in this way, but they repurposed the technique to fight their own battle. And, you know, like you see in the 1950s, similar to today, the industries involved gave their front group a really innocuous sounding name, the Air Pollution Foundation. And it was similar, in fact, to that of a genuine citizens group that sprung up in Los Angeles at the time called the Pure Air Committee. And that has also remained a constant for these front groups, you know, giving them a plausible sounding name that appropriates the legitimacy of genuine grassroots organization, which gives them power, but it also takes away the power of genuine grassroots, which is why this kind of tactic is so insidious. You see, for example, in the 1990s, the industry were involved in a group called the Global Climate Coalition, which was, you know, again, sounds fairly innocuous, but it was corporate America's primary vehicle for climate denial. and another called the Information Council on the Environment, which was a separate coal industry climate denial coalition. And the Council for Solid Waste Solutions is another one, which was a plastics industry group that claimed its purpose was to promote recycling when it was actually designed to promote public acceptability of the use of plastics. So, yeah, as you say, the list goes on and on. And over the years, it has become a key component of the PR playbook for industries looking to influence public opinion and policy. It's been institutionalized now, really, on a widespread level. And I think this happened, you can see it happening from around the 1970s onwards, you know, mobilizing the grassroots became a go-to feature of industry PR campaigns, especially then throughout the 80s and 90s, with firms specializing in using new technology, computer software, to compile voter or consumer profiles that these companies, that their clients could use to harness and build up grassroots support. So it's an operation that's become more sophisticated and targeting specific groups of people and so on. And yeah, you mentioned the Midwest, like around the fracking boom, there was a big explosion of these kinds of front groups centered around rolling out fracking operations with names. For example, there was one in Colorado that really struck as it was called Boulder Citizens for Reasonable Energy Decisions in Boulder, Colorado. And a local reporter found out that its only major donor was the Colorado Oil and Gas Association. So again, it looks like a small town. Well, okay, sorry. Boulder's not a small town. It looks like a city-based residents association in favor of fracking, but it was actually started by the oil and gas industry. And let me just say one more thing about that. I mean, we could talk endlessly about the front groups. You know, the gas industry has one called Natural Allies for a Clean Energy Future, which pitches itself as a coalition made up of responsible stakeholders, but its funding members include pipeline companies and gas trade associations. And again, this group has sponsored research and publicized it to position gas as a more climate-friendly fuel than other fuel sources. So what you see is really today's front groups utilizing today's technology more sophisticatedly. Online petitions, ads, Facebook groups, all of those kinds of things. But essentially, the operation is the same. It's a case of hidden or veiled industry support for groups that are aimed at either facilitating oil and gas development or obstructing clean air or climate action. But I would say maybe what's changing today, in addition to that, is that maybe we now know more about these techniques and how industries use them. And so we have more evidence than ever, both from history and from today, to prove it. So perhaps that's where we start to bring about change, to hold these groups accountable, expose what's really happening behind them, and possibly to overcome the damage that they do.
We can only hope. It's funny. You mentioned some of these sort of anodyne sounding front group names, and I was reminded, when I was living in Detroit, Michigan, there's a big investor-owned utility there called DTE Energy, and it's pretty widely reviled by the public around there. Serious reliability issues, also a major campaigner against clean energy projects, as most investor-owned utilities are. And I was just looking up some of the front group names, and they include such bangers as Alliance for Michigan Power and Citizens for Energizing Michigan's Economy. So,
wow.
Really, really delightful stuff.
Yeah, really just sticking with the playbook there.
Yeah. One of the other fascinating notes that I observed in your research is that as early as the 1940s, WISPA was sponsoring studies downplaying the effects of smog and air pollution, as you mentioned earlier. And they were working with the Stanford Research Institute, which has had a sort of like loose affiliation with Stanford University over the years. And it made me think about how just a couple of years ago, in 2022, Stanford University founded a new sustainability school, the Dorr School of Sustainability, which made a lot of headlines for the wrong reasons, namely its extensive ties to the oil industry. It has accepted over $1.69 billion in oil money from the likes of Chevron, Saudi Aramco, Shell, BP. So I guess how would you compare that kind of influence in academia to industry use of third-party front groups and direct political lobbying?
Yeah, well, that's fascinating too. Great question. I think that having looked at the documents and studied this early period in detail, it seems to me that the two go very much hand in hand. You know, people see the research and the Stanford name, and it gives it a really powerful credibility. It also obscures industry's direct role, at least like at face value, and it leverages the reputational benefits of the Stanford name. And this kind of, that kind of funding, that figure you quoted, it's just astronomical, isn't it? It's just an incredibly large sum. And it affords its own kind of influence, I think, that actually goes beyond influencing public opinion or the outcome of a specific push for air pollution control. I think with that type of funding, you see industry influencing, you know, what is and what is not on the table for research by these institutions, skewing the agenda. And, you know, one of the Doer School's own experts has noted that oil companies tend to donate to efforts related to solutions like carbon capture and hydrogen, which they see as compatible with their business plans, but which alone are not at the moment going to get us to a scenario where we bring emissions down anywhere near enough to prevent the worst effects of climate change. I mean, for example, in 2023, the school announced it would be focusing on atmospheric greenhouse gas removal. And that was a decision reportedly made with input from oil and gas companies. So in this way, there's a similarity between, you know, the Air Pollution Foundation, whose research program was heavily influenced by oil companies and which focused, again, on industry-friendly solutions, and this dynamic that you see played out at the Doer School at Stanford today. I mean, another point to make is that, again and again, studies have shown that industry-funded science is more likely to be favourable to the industry supplying the funding. And not only that, but academics can become advocates for industry, perhaps not deliberately, but industry certainly uses academics or the things they say as useful voices and statements in support of its own favoured points of view. So, say, for example, on carbon capture today or previously, with you positioning gas as a supposed bridge fuel. And when you widen out and you look at the sponsorship of academia and the use of front groups, you start to see right from the very beginning how the oil industry has polluted not only the natural environment, the air that we breathe and the atmosphere that allows the planet to maintain life as we know it, but also it's polluted the information environment. All of these attempts to fund and publicise industry-friendly science have the effect of clouding the information environment. You see this in the 1940s, which is when Stanford Research Institute was founded by one of the West Coast oil industry's most powerful figures, and it was funded by the oil industry. And even then, actually, this early industry funding of research by the Stanford Research Institute that was affiliated but funded by industry, that was controversial. And one faculty member likened it then to a laundry operating with the Stanford identity. And I know some people would argue that the same holds true for today.
Definitely. And you mentioned a little bit about, greenwashing and things like carbon capture, carbon removal, dirty hydrogen. Can you talk about that in relation to some of the stuff that the Air Pollution Foundation did and what you found in your work? They were kind of talking even in the 1950s about potentially just sort of solving everything through techno solutions with automobiles and making mass transit irrelevant. And to me, there's a line to be drawn there between that and what we see today with these oil companies talking about alternative fuels and carbon capture and all of these other so-called sustainable solutions that generally typically amount to greenwashing.
Yeah, definitely. No, it's really stark when you read the documents and you look at the historical records. You almost do a double take of like, wait, hang on. They were discussing all of this in the 1950s and we're having the same discussions now. Obviously, it's not carbon capture then, but it's a similar principle. I mean, straight off, in the 1950s, you see Whisper and Union Oil, which is now Chevron, dismissing the Air Pollution Foundation's plan to investigate mass public transport systems as a potential solution to the air pollution problem by stating that, and this is what I'm quoting here, is they say, nothing constructive could ever come from such a survey. They didn't want the Air Pollution Foundation investigating how mass public transportation might be able to replace the use of automobiles and so provide a solution. That they so much so that they described it as, you know, completely unconstructive, which seems extraordinary to write that off at that early stage. But there we go, that's what they did. And I think, yeah, in terms of potential techno fixes from automobiles, the foundation talked a lot about technology that would reduce harmful emissions from automobiles, so through catalytic converters. And they certainly dangled that in front of the public as a likely solution that was on the horizon, you know, almost on the horizon, maybe next year, or if not next year, then the year after, but very soon. And however, though, in reality, there was a huge problem because leaded gas gasoline that was used ubiquitously at the time damages catalytic converters, so you couldn't use them both together. And despite what the Air Pollution Foundation publication said about the, you know, imminent prospects of a solution, both the oil industry and the auto industry really dragged their heels on the use of catalytics. And it wasn't until the Clean Air Act amendments of 1970, which mandated stricter emission standards, that the use of catalytic converters became widespread. So even though the technology had been sitting on the shelf, we now know this, for several years prior. It was only in response to externally mandated legislation that industry finally changed. It was from 1975, leaded gasoline was banned from most new vehicles so that catalytic converters could be fitted and emission standard met. So that, I think that's a really good example of how techno fixes were not actually even implemented until forced by legislation. And in the case of the catalytic converters, that was actually an actual solution. It required a lot of heavy lifting, but it was feasible. It could be done. It could actually tackle the emissions problem in terms of, you know, reducing some of the toxic, harmful pollutants that were coming out of cars. But that's not necessarily the case with industry's current promises. So its current promises on carbon capture are not proven, certainly not proven at scale, and they're also fraught with risks that are not always communicated to the public. So the dangers of carbon dioxide leaks and other matters, explosions. So yes, I think the parallel holds up when you look at how the industry fights in, you know, a new paradigm, like then say mass public transportation in the 1950s, and today a shift to full-scale electrification powered by non-fossil sources that would actually solve the problem. So by, you know, focusing attention on techno fixes that would allow continued use of fossil fuels for as long as possible, the industry then as now would effectively protect profits and continue to boost shareholder return and protect business as usual.
Yeah, actually what you were saying about the Air Pollution Foundation's work on the auto industry and catalytic converters and sort of that ending up being a tool of delay, that really feels like one of the operative things, especially when it comes to something like carbon capture, which, you know, I've spent some time sort of working on in the policy world. And what I find is that the investments that utilities would have to make in this kind of infrastructure are enormous. And, you know, it's possible that they are somewhat ameliorated by some of the federal incentives through the Inflation Reduction Act. But generally speaking, when carbon capture is built into an emissions reductions or clean energy law and it's included there, utilities can kind of just get away with saying, yeah, we'll do that. And meanwhile, they're using their current energy mix. They're not building out wind or solar or other sources that are actually displacing fossil fuels off the grid. And then when the legislation's deadline hits in 2030, 2035, whatever, uh-oh, all of a sudden you end up having to just sort of back up all your plans. And I think that's an area of high concern right now, to say nothing of the question of whether carbon capture actually works.
No, right, exactly. Aside from that, just foregrounding something as this miraculous solution that will take place at some point in the future. Classic tool of delay. And yeah, exactly. You can see that in the Air Pollution Foundation of the 1950s, very much so.
Yeah, well, speaking of delay, we recently saw the close of negotiations of COP29, the United Nations Global Conference on Climate Change, in November, held in Azerbaijan, after 2023's COP28 was held in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. Of course, Azerbaijan and the UAE, two of the world's most oil-dependent nations. And I think from the perspective of a lot of activists, a lot of civil society groups, at least the ones that I've spoken with, the involvement of the oil industry in these negotiations has it's almost reached something of a fever pitch, or a point of no return, and their presence at the COPs has become ubiquitous. And do you see that as kind of an ultimate evolution of what you saw in these early PR efforts?
Yes, in some ways they are very much connected. I think, again, it's part of the apparatus of influence that the industry created, first to fight air pollution and then to fight climate action. And yeah, you know, research has shown that industry were present right at the very beginning, the earliest UN talks on the environment. They embedded themselves within that and then again into the COP process. And interestingly enough, the Stanford Research Institute, which was founded by a director of Standard Oil of California, now Chevron, which hosted what I believe was the first national conference on air pollution that took place in 1949, in what was an attempt to get out front, to try to control the narrative, to shape the direction of research and the national conversation on air pollution in a way that's not very different from oil companies' attempts to influence the outcome of the COP process. And as a lasting metaphor, at the second of these conferences, this is wild really, the smog was so bad, it encircled the Huntington Hotel in Pasadena, where the conference is being held, which is once again a really apt illustration of the environmental pollution caused by the fossil fuels industry, and again, the accompanying information pollution that surrounded it. Because it was at this conference that the LA Times lead air pollution reporter, this brilliant reporter called Ed Ainsworth, told his fellow reporters, he said, "Hey, don't believe anything that Stanford Research Institute tell you. They need watching," he told his colleagues. "Yeah, they need watching as they are employed by oil companies." So I suppose that's an ongoing rallying cry to reporters and journalists everywhere to keep watching, you know, to keep calling the industry to account, as it was then in 1950s, so now in 2025.
Yeah, this is very fascinating history, and obviously, you know, in a lot of ways, it feels like not a lot has changed. Lots of through lines to the present day. And it does make me think that there has sort of been a recent debate among some activists and academics, particularly on the left, about the practical utility for movements of uncovering fossil fuel disinformation and how to make that resonate with people, and you know, whether it actually does enough to change opinions among ordinary people. So I was wondering about what your take is on how research like yours can be most effectively used to reach people and to affect change.
Well, I can't speak for everyone. You know, what appeals to someone doesn't appeal to the next person. And I guess that is what makes the world go round. However, I would say that telling these stories from history of what happened in a human way, being able to find out how people's lives were involved and intricately woven into this story. For example, the president of the Air Pollution Foundation, when he came into contact with the industry, that's a very personal moment. It's a very powerful scene. So trying to bring that to life really humanizes this issue, I think, and tells the story in perhaps a way that brings new light to it. and allows people to connect with it in a different way on a human level, not just only facts and figures, which are really important, but also to see that this is a struggle. You know, it's a struggle to find out the truth, and it's a struggle to fight for the kind of society and world we want to live in. So, I would also say that, you know, for those of us lucky to live in a free society, we get to vote for our political leaders. And, you know, these votes are based on information about the world we live in. If this information is incomplete or distorted, then our freedom to choose is diminished. So I do think this research and all work actually that aims to uncover what happened in the past and what is still happening today in our world forms a really important part of what it means to live in a democracy and to uphold those freedoms for future generations.
Well said. I guess as we just wrap things up here, if there's one thing you want the general public to take away from your research and your reporting on this subject, what is it?
Okay, thank you. Yes, I think this history is really important, and it's shaped the way we live now and the problems that we face. And I think if we understand how we got here, then we have a much, much better chance of figuring out how to find a solution to the climate crisis, to air pollution, that really works, a really lasting solution that is going to help us solve the crisis and to leave a planet behind that is capable of sustaining life for future generations.
Absolutely. Well, I have a lot of respect for your work, and I really appreciate your time coming on. Rebecca John, investigative reporter and researcher, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Roshan, and thank you for all the work that you're doing. It's brilliant. Thank you.
That was my conversation with investigative journalist and reporter Rebecca John. Thank you once again to Rebecca for taking the time to speak with me. And if you'd like to read her article yourself, and I certainly think it's worth reading, you can find it at DESMOG, that's DESMOG.com. Rebecca and I ended our conversation speaking about the value of this type of research and historical work for the climate movement and for moving people to take action and even just to learn more about the power relations that drive climate change. And truth be told, I do struggle with this question because the reality is, as I said at the top of the show, oil and gas are so deeply embedded in our political economy and our institutions. They're fundamental to the shape of contemporary capitalism. What would day-to-day life look like without petrochemical products? What would oil-producing nations do to retain a grip on the political power derived from their productive capacity? A world without oil and gas extraction and combustion, which is the world that we need, will necessarily be a world that has been completely transformed. And the disinformation and denialism spread by the oil and gas industry is just one challenge of many that need to be navigated. But with all that being said, even with the knowledge that it is a piece of a far bigger puzzle, I do believe that this work has inherent value. It's crucial history that must be documented, at bare minimum, so we have a full picture. Whether or not this kind of research does or doesn't reach people immediately or move them to action, we collectively deserve to know about the manipulative actions of powerful actors. We deserve critical history from below. And I appreciate Rebecca and her work in delivering that history so we can learn from the past and the present as we work to fight for the future. That's all I've got for today. As always, thank you so much for tuning in to The Rift on WEFT 90.1 FM, community radio for Champaign, Illinois, and East Central Illinois. As always, you can listen to recordings of The Rift on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and various aggregators where you find your podcasts. The recording of this episode will be up later this evening. And up next, we got some tunes up until the top of the hour. And then at 4 p.m., we will have On the Move with Herbert Burnett. I'll be back here for the next episode of The Rift 2 weeks from now on Sunday, January 19th. We'll see you then. Thanks.
Programming is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT, along with our community partners, including Furniture Lounge, The Upper Bout, Josh Gallagher at Edward Jones Financial, and A to Z Painting and Decorating. Listener-supported, volunteer-run since 1981. Community radio for East Central Illinois, 90.1 FM WEFT.